So in the book of Deuteronomy, he doesn't mention sacrifice. Sacrifice is out of the law. The ark is almost completely out of memory. And most importantly, sacrifice is out of life, out of ordinary life, out of day-to-day life. Now, this is a move that we've studied, that we've learned. We've also learned that this move, in a deep sense, failed. That the attempt to take God out of the temple, the attempt to create a religion where sacrifice is there, but it's not extremely important. It's not the center of religion. According to Jeremiah chapter 7, the people of Israel did not fulfill the spirit of the book of Deuteronomy. They were saying, Heichal Hashem, Heichal Hashem. They were saying that in some way God does dwell in the temple, and as a psychological result, they thought that they could do anything they want, that destruction will not happen, that they enjoy complete immunity, meaning a distorted theology that God is in the temple created a distorted psychology that they have immunity, and it created a distorted society where they were not sensitive to the poor, to the weak, to the widow. Why? Because they felt they don't need to be sensitive in order to be protected. The temple is protecting them. So that's one move we did. Today, I want to add another layer to that. But before I do that, I want to stop, pause, and reflect on what we're doing here. We're trying to understand the book of Deuteronomy. We're trying to understand the last speech of Moses, but we're not using modern interpreters to understand this book. We're also not using ancient interpretations. The rabbis, the midrashim, we're not even using them to read, to understand this book. Our move is intertextual move, which means we're using the Bible to understand the Bible. Because I do believe that the best interpretation of the Bible is the Bible itself. And we're going to make a similar move today after we try to understand Jeremiah, to ask what happened with that speech, what happened with that message. We're going to now move forward to Isaiah. In the book of Isaiah, this is the second part of Isaiah, the part that scholars call the second Isaiah. Isaiah 47 describes what happened in the end to Babel, to Babylon. This is interesting because the Babylonians were the ones that destroyed the first temple. So here's a question. What happened to the people, to the Babylonians that destroyed the temple? God punished Israel using the Babylonians. Then what did God do to the Babylonians? So please open Isaiah chapter 47. Now this is a chapter about the future of Babylon, and this is a chapter about the destruction of Babylon, about the destruction of those who destroyed the temple and destroyed Jerusalem. So I'll read this very briefly, very quickly. I want to pick up a motif from here. Redi ushvi al afar betulat bat bavel. He's calling Babylon a bat, a female. It's interesting, in the Bible, many times the prophets treat great cities and great empires like they're female. By the way, that includes Bat Zion. It includes Jerusalem. Cities are seen like, are feminine in many parts of the Bible. And how does he speak about Betulat Bat, about Bavel, about the Babylonian Empire? Shvi Dumam, Uvoi V'choshech Bat Kasdim, Ki Lo Tosifi Yikre'u Lach, Geveret HaMamlachot. You won't be anymore the Geveret, the princess, the master of all kingdoms. Isaiah is saying to Bavel that their awareness that she is the Gveret HaMamlachot, the leader of all leaders, the master of all kingdoms, that self-awareness of Babel. Isaiah saying, the party is over, their time is up, and their leadership is going to end. I'm skipping now to verse 7. Vatomri le'olam eheye gevaret. Bavel is saying to herself that forever she will rule, that her politics, her power, her control will last forever, that she's enjoying a sense of immunity, that she can't ever collapse. עד לא שמת אלה על ליבך, לא זכרת אחריתה. He's saying Babel wasn't aware of how fragile her power is, how limited her control can be. This is the tendency of people that are successful. Companies that are successful. Countries that are successful. They can't imagine their fall. They can't imagine their collapse. And this is the story of Babel. She couldn't imagine that her time is up, that maybe she'll fall. Verse 8, Ve'ata shim'i zot adina. Listen, now this is a pampered woman, adina, hayoshevet lavetach, that is sitting with comfort and an illusion of certainty and immunity. Ha'omra bilvava, she is saying to herself, ani ve'afsi od. I'm the only one around. There is nothing out there larger than us, bigger than us, that could threaten us and end our control and our power. Lo eshev almana velo edash chod. She will never be a widow. Nothing bad would ever happen to her. Vatavon alach shtei ele rega biyom echad shchol ve'almon ketumam bau alaych. And all the worst things, the horrors of life, could all happen in 1 second. You can't predict the future. You can't ever be certain that the success you're enjoying, you'll continue to enjoy. And here we're coming to the words I was waiting for. What gave her a sense of immunity? What's giving Babylon that illusion of control? And he says, Berov kshafaych. It's because of magic. Berov kshafaych. Be'atzmat chavereich me'od. Vativdechi bera'atech. Amart ein ro'eni. You're sure no one is watching me. No one is seeing me. Chochmatech v'da'atech. Your wisdom. Hi shovavtich. Your wisdom is what seduced you to believe there is nothing beyond you, nothing above you. What is the Babylonian wisdom? What is the Egyptian wisdom? Kshafim. Magic. Mysterious rituals that give you the illusion that you're in control, that you can guard your success through rituals. Vatomer bilibech ani ve'afsi od, and you're saying to yourself, it's only me. And this is a story, I'm skipping to verse 12. Imdina bechavereich veberov kshafayich kasher yagat minerutayich ulay tochli ho'il ulay ta'arotzi. He's saying to Babel cynically, ask all your magicians if they could save you when God decides that your party is over. I want to notice that this character of Babylon is a mirror image of the character of Jerusalem. Why was Jerusalem destroyed? Because they had a sense of immunity. They had certainty. Nothing bad could happen. Why? Because of the temple. Why did Babylon fail? Why did they become so cocky and arrogant? Why did they have the illusion of immunity, that nothing bad could happen to them? Because of their religious rituals, because of their magic. So Jerusalem was destroyed because of bad religion. And the destroyers of Jerusalem were destroyed because of bad religion. Now let me make a judgment. Religion at its worst creates the illusion of control. Religion at its best trains your mind to accept the fact that we have no control. What is religion about? Is it about having certainty, or is it about mystery? Is it about thinking that by performing rituals, I know what's going to happen? Or you perform rituals in order to train your mind to realize you never know what's going to happen. Religion at its best is about mystery. It's about giving up control. Religion at its worst is about certainty, and it's about abusing control and using religion as an instrument for control. With all that in mind, I would like now to do something, to quote Monty Python, completely different. I would like to use this framing is, what does religion do to us? Does it train our minds to understand the world is a mystery and that the future is not accessible to us? Or does it seduce your mind to believe that through religion you can know the future and you can control your destiny? Religion could do both things. Till today, religion could lead to magic or to mystery and humility. And with that question, I would like now to introduce ourselves to a new figure in this drama, to the only king in the Bible that completely implemented and fulfilled the vision of Moshe, the book of Dvarim. I am talking about HaMelech Yoshiyahu. And we're going to do this by reading very briefly the move of the king of Deuteronomy, the implementer of Deuteronomy, in Kings 2, chapter 22. וַיִּבְשְׁמֹנָה־עֲשָׂר שָׁנָה לַמֶּלֶךְ יְהוּשִׁיָּהוּ שָׁלַח הַמֶּלֶךְ אֶת שָׁפָן בֶּן אֲצֶלְיָהוּ בֶּן מְשֻׁלָּם הַסּוֹפֵר בֵּית אֲדֹנָי לְמֹר. So in the 18th year of King Josiah, he makes a decision to perform renovations in the temple through a person called Shaphan. And they renovate the temple. And when you renovate a house, as many of the people who are watching this, viewing this know, when you renovate the house, you start finding things. You lift the floor, you break down the walls. Suddenly, things that were lost for years, maybe, are found. But at this story, something very dramatic was found. What did they find? They found an ancient text, an ancient scroll, an ancient book. This is verse 8. Ve'omer Chilkiyahu ha-kohen el Shaphan ha-sofer, sefer Torah matzati bebet Adonai. I found a sefer Torah. So what does he do with this sefer Torah? Verse 11, he takes it to the king, reads it to the king. How does the king react to this ancient book that was now found? Verse 11, וַיִּקִי שְׁמוֹ הַמֶּלֶךְ אֶת דִּבְרֵי סֶפֶר הַתּוֹרָה וַיִּקְרָא אֶת בְּגָדָיו. He listens to the Torah and he tears his clothes off. He is shattered when he listens to the Torah. Why is he shattered? Because when he listens to the Torah, he suddenly notices and realizes that there's a tremendous gap between the life we're supposed to live and the life that we are living. And that gap is humongous. And he realizes the gap. But then King Josiah decides that he will be the king that closes the gap. What is the gap? What is the book that they found? Most scholars agree on this point. He found a version of the book of Deuteronomy. Actually, many of the Mefarshim and their rabbis agree with this. What he found was a version of the book of Deuteronomy, of Sefer Dvarim. So sometime 500 years after Sefer Dvarim, they find, and historically we know when this is, King Josiah was one of the last kings of Yehuda, one of the last kings before exile. And here he finds a book that claims it was written by Moshe before they entered Yehuda, before they entered Israel. So one of the last kings of Israel, one of the last kings before they leave the land, is exposed to the book, to the message of the prophet, to his speech that he gave the people while they entered the land. So what does he do? Chapter 23. Vayishlach ha-melech vayasfut kol ziknei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. So he gathers everyone together. Ve'yal ha-melech bet Adonai v'chol ish Yehuda v'chol yosvei Yerushalayim ito v'akohanim v'nevim v'chol ha'am mikaton v'ad gadol. All the people are getting together. Mikaton v'ad gadol. All classes, all works of society. Va'yikra be'oznehem et kol divrei sefer ha-brit ha-nimtza be'bet Adonai. He's reading the text to them. Ve'yamod ha-melech al ha'amud v'yichrot et ha-brit lifnei Adonai. ללכת אחר אדוני ולשמור מצוותיו ואת עדותיו ואת חוקותיו בכל לב, בכל נפש, להקים את דברי הברית הזאת הכתובים על הספר הזה ויעמוד כל העם בברית. So what he does, he gathers the people, he reads them the text, and they sign the covenant. They all accept and agree on the covenant. This is the renewal of the devotion of the people to the ancient covenant, to the last words of Moshe, of Moses. I want to stop here and just notice something. This is not very typical for Jews, especially not the biblical Hebrews. The story of the biblical Hebrews is when prophets preach to them, not always, but almost always, they reject the prophets. Either they ignore the prophet, or they put the prophet in jail, or, as Nehemiah writes, they kill the prophets. They almost never listen to the prophets, either the people that don't listen to prophets. So much they don't listen to prophets to ask them to change, ask them to do tshuva, that when the rabbis are searching for a role model of a nation that listens to a prophet and did tshuva, they couldn't find one good, clear example for that in the entire Bible, so they had to go to the Gentiles, to Nineveh, to the Assyrians, to the enemies of Israel, to be a role model for the people of Israel as tshuva, the story of Yonah. But here we have a story about the people listening to God's words and transforming their ways. There'll be another example of this in the time of Ezra. He will read the Torah to them and they will make a covenant with God. I want to notice something interesting before I move forward. The Bible is about the people that refuse to listen to God's words when it comes from prophets. But they have a tendency to listen to God's words when it comes from books. They don't listen to prophets, but you'll read a book to them and they transform. Why is it that for Jews in the Bible, it was easier to listen to texts and harder to listen to people? With that question in mind, I'll just continue to understand the revolution of Josiah. After the covenant, after the big covenant, so now he's starting to reform ancient Judaism. What does he do? First, he takes all the idolatry from the temple, burns it, and destroys it. Second, because in the book of Deuteronomy is about centralization of the cult of worship, he takes all the temples that are outside of Jerusalem and destroys them too, trying to turn the vision of Moshe into a reality of the king Yoshiyahu, of the time of Yoshiyahu. And then towards the end, it says, verse 25, now in Kings 2, chapter 23, verse 25, it says, when the text describes King Josiah, this is how it describes him. V'chamo lo haya lefanav melech, asher shav el Adonai, b'chol levavo, b'chol nafsho, u'v'chol me'odo, k'chol Torat Moshe, v'acharav lo kam kamo. Bechol levavo, bechol nafsho, bechol meodo. Those are three words that describe, that's how Moshe is asking the people to be devoted to God. Bechol levavcha, bechol nafshecha, v'bechol meodecha. To be devoted completely and absolutely to surrender to God. And then the text says, the only person ever to fulfill that vision of the book of Deuteronomy was King Yoshiyahu. And it says, before him, no one did that. After him, no one did that. King Yoshiyahu was a fluke of history, a Mosaic island in an anti-Mosaic Bible, in a world where no one fulfilled, where no one worshipped God, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol meodecha. King Yoshiyahu did. What happened with King Yoshiyahu? What happened with him? What was his destiny? So, this great king that reformed ancient Judaism, that fulfilled the last speech of Moshe, the only king that did that, this island of religious perfection, what happened with him? So for understand that, I have to step back to give some context to this. So King Yoshiyahu was one of the last kings of Judah. He had a son called Jehoahaz, and Jehoahaz had a son called Eliakim, and Eliakim had a son called Yehoiachin, and after Yehoiachin, he had an uncle called Tzidkiyahu, and those were the last kings of Yehudah. But there's a story here. And here's the story. After Yoshiyahu dies, Jewish sovereignty collapsed. They lost their independence. Why did they lose their independence? Because the Egyptians came and controlled Yehuda and appointed, and they took Yehoahaz, his son, exiled him, and they appointed another son of his, Eliakim, called him Yehoiakim, and he was the Egyptian. He was appointed by the Egyptians to govern Yehuda, which means Yoshiyahu was the last king of Yehuda, of independent, sovereign Yehuda. So you ask, why was this great righteous king the last king? Why was this great righteous king that worshipped God, why was this the king that his son already lost the kingdom? The Tanakh explains why. It was because of a dramatic mistake that Yoshiyahu made. I'm now skipping to verse 28. Ve'yeter divrei Yoshiyahu v'chol asher asa halo hem k'tuvim al sefer divrei yamim l'malchei Yehuda. Beyamav ala paro necho melech Mitzrayim al melech Ashur al ne'ar prat v'yelech ha'melech Yoshiyahu likrato. This is a very dramatic historic event described in very undramatic words. Here's the drama. Paro necho. This is described with more words, by the way, in Chronicles, in Divrei Hayamim. And this is how it's described. Paro wants to go to war with Assyria. Now, there's a problem. Paro, the king of Egypt, wants to go to war with Assyria, but what's the problem? He doesn't have a shared border with Assyria. Who interferes? Who's the barrier between Egypt and Assyria? Who's in between? Israel. Eretz Canaan. So he has to go through Israel to attack Assyria. But he doesn't want to go, but he doesn't want to fight Israel. He just wants to go through Israel to fight Assyria. Now, this is a problem we have in the Bible. This is the politics of the Bible. There's two great empires in the ancient Near East, Mesopotamia, Mesopotamian kingdoms, and Egypt. They're the two great empires, and the Bible takes place in between. And now it's beautiful from the point of view of literature and from the point of view of theology. They're trying to say that the alternative to the great civilizations was created in between those civilizations. It's beautiful. It's poetic. It's great poetry, but it's bad politics. Why is it bad for politics? Because when you're right in between the two great empires, it means that there are wars. When they fight each other, where are they fighting each other? Right over your head. So here's the story. So the Egyptian king wants to go to war with Assyria. And he wants to do everything he can to avoid entering Israel. So he minimizes his movement into Israel. They leave Egypt. They go into, just follow me with your imagination, through where Gaza is today. And then through Ashkelon. Following me? And then where Rishon, Lezion is today, right? Tel Aviv. Then you continue going north, but there's a moment you have to take a right. You have to go east. You have to enter, the shore is not Israel. It's a land of the Philistines. Now there's a moment they have to enter Israel. They do that where Megiddo is. There is Megiddo today, and there was Megiddo in the Bible. He takes a right in Megiddo to enter. That's the gate into Eretz Israel. King Josiah decides to stop him. King Josiah decides to go into military conflict with Egypt, with Paro. He decides to do that. Now I have a question. Why would he decide to do that? For a scrawny, weak kingdom like Yehuda to go to war with the Egyptian Empire is an irrational political decision. That would be like Israel of today deciding to go to war with Russia or China or, you know what, with the United States of America. That's not something we're going to do. I mean, as long as we're rational, you know that there are strategic equations in the world. You realize where there's a gap of power and the weak doesn't attack the much more powerful. Not Yoshiyahu. He attacks Egypt, and guess what happens? Well, the text says what happens. This righteous king attacks Egypt, and what do? They kill him. and he dies. And they bury him in Jerusalem. But it doesn't end there, because now they were messing with the Egyptians. So when the Egyptians go through Yehuda, go to Assyria, fight Assyria, when the battle is over, they make a U-turn, and on their way back, they don't go, now they go directly through Yehuda. They conquer Yehuda, and they appoint a governor. They appoint Eliakim, call him Jehoiakim, and now he is the governor appointed by the Egyptians of Yehuda. Which means that the person that as a result of his mistake, we lost our sovereignty, was Yoshiyahu. And then the Babylonians will come. They'll capture Yehuda from the Egyptians. There'll be a rebellion against the Babylonians. The temple will be destroyed. The people of Yehuda will be exiled. Where did the mistake begin? It began with King Yoshiyahu. Now this creates a very big question. How is it that such a successful king was such a failure? He was successful spiritually. He was successful religiously. He was a failure strategically and politically. But I have a question. Is it possible there's a connection between the two? Is it possible that there's a connection that the king that worshipped God, b'chol nafsho, b'chol levavo, b'chol meodo, goes to war with Egypt? Is it possible that what led him to go to an irrational war with Egypt is that he thought that since he's the person that reformed ancient Judaism to be completely devoted to God, maybe he thought that means that God is with him, that God is in his pocket? If we're so devoted to God, God is probably devoted to us. And with that in mind, he goes to war with Egypt, and guess what? He loses, he's killed, and we lose our independence to Egypt. Maybe this is the third story that we've learned together about false sense of immunity. Maybe even complete I think the story in Kings 2, chapter 24, is a critique on what religion can do to your mind. It could seduce you to believe that because you are so pious and devoted to God, you don't have to be rational when you do politics. You can go to war with the Egyptians because God is with us. And there is an important critique here. The fact that you're righteous, the fact that you're so surrendering and devoted to God does not mean that God is in your pocket and that God is protecting you. You just can't count on that. This chapter is a very important critique of that kind of religiosity. And if the whole purpose of the last words of Moshe were to create a religious awareness, but you don't think you have control, sure, there's a lot of irony here. And the irony is that the king that fulfilled the vision of Moshe, even he didn't understand the greatest idea of Moshe. And that is that God doesn't work for you. You work for God, God doesn't work for you. You worship God, God doesn't guarantee you and as a reward anything. The world of religion as control, religion as magic, religion as power, that world is over. And even the king that implemented the laws of Moshe failed to implement the message of Moshe. But there's something else going on here. And with this something else, I want to set the stage for our next lecture. One of the important things that King Josiah did was he founded Pesach. This is a very important moment in this text. Vayitzav ha-melech et kol ha'am le'mor, asu Pesach la'adonai Elohechem. Ka'katuv al sefer ha-brit hazeh. Saying to them, we have to celebrate Passover. Why? Because it says in that book we've just found that we need to celebrate Passover. And then it says, ki lo na'asa ka'pesach hazeh. Mimei ha-shoftim asher shaftu et Yisrael, v'kol yemei malchei Yisrael le'malchei Yehuda. It says that this Passover, in this way, wasn't celebrated all the years of the judges and all the years of the kings. That was hundreds of years that Pesach in the collective form wasn't celebrated. King Josiah renewed Pesach as a collective festival. He renewed the Pesach. Now this is, I find very weird, that the people didn't celebrate Pesach, at least not collectively. They didn't celebrate Pesach. It is what it says. I know according to the Pew Report, American Jews, even very unaffiliated Jews, what do? They go to Seder in high percentages. They go to Seder. Turns out Jews today, even very secular Jews, are more frum than the Bible Jews. At least they do Pesach. They didn't do Pesach from the days of the Shoftim. It seems like the people who left Egypt did not celebrate leaving Egypt. Isn't that weird? And then King Josiah revives the Pesach. It's a renaissance of Pesach. And I want to end with a question. Is it a coincidence that the king that renewed Pesach went to war with Egypt? Is it a coincidence that the king that renewed the awareness that we escaped miraculously Egypt, he was the king that went to war with Egypt? With that question, we will begin our next lecture. Thank you very much. That's the mitzvah in Deuteronomy. In the interpretation of Shabbat in Deuteronomy, Shabbat is about letting go. It's about not controlling. It's collapse of social hierarchy one day a week.